Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Perhaps the major center of conflict in the world is in the Mideast. If we could find a way to bring peace to the Mideast, we could help bring peace to the world. And we could slow the flood of refugees pouring out of unstable and dangerous countries. Our two guests today believe that peace is possible. In fact, they just returned from a visit to the Mideast. Their approach: teach yoga and promote inner peace, one person at a time. Our first guest, Ruth Hartung, is the director and owner of the Seven Centers Yoga Art Studio, which she founded in 1999 in Sedona, Arizona. The center has a nonprofit arm for yoga outreach, bringing yoga to those who can benefit from it. With her is Mira Murphy, a skilled yoga teacher, also trained in Ayurvedic medicine and cooking as a path to health and wellness. They stayed with me in Washington, D.C., both on their way to the Mideast and their way back this week. Ruth Hartung and Mira Murphy, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eleanor. We're happy to be here.
Yes. Well, I'm impressed that you two went on your brave adventure marching off to the Mideast where so many people are fleeing. good for you for seeing your service in that arena and doing what you can do to help out there. Tell our listeners, why did you decide to go to the Mideast?
Well, this was a continuation of a journey that began in 2015 when I went with Mira's mother, Ramajyoti Vernon, who's a well-known yoga teacher, and Rob Schwar of Give Back Yoga Foundation in Colorado, and also Suzanne Manafort, who was a mindful yoga therapist. And we went in 2015 at the invitation of Farasha, which is a yoga studio in Ramallah, and to do some workshops. Yoga workshops. And they set up yoga workshops for psychosocial counselors. These would be Palestinians that were working in the refugee camps. And so we had workshops for men and also workshops for women, yoga workshops for women. And so it was out of that experience that we have gone back with a slight variation and a new aspect to the plan.
Good. Well, tell us, you know, what is your plan? It's just every day we're reading about our refugees and the problems there and literally millions of people fleeing their homes, trying to get to safety, get to food, get to a better way of life. What is your plan, and how was it adapted on this trip?
Well, a lot of people are looking at political solutions, which is in some ways an outside-in point of view. And what we were bringing to the table was the idea of working from the inside out through yoga. And yoga is universal. It doesn't belong to just any particular religion or group or ethnic. It's beyond that. It's really about the human being and coming into alignment with their greatest potential. So that would be kind of an esoteric way of putting it. Practically, yoga, and in particular therapeutic yoga, can help people address and deal with stress and chronic conditions in their body. And that was something that we found was going on a lot when we were teaching yoga in the refugee camps in 2015. And so one of our takeaways from that trip was that these people really needed a particular type of yoga, and so that would be a yoga that focused upon sort of the chronic stress that they're underneath, as well as something that they could do to be able to help them with, you know, certain common conditions that you find in that culture. And each country has their own type of issues, and we found that there was a lot of There's a lot of diabetes. There's high blood pressure. There are a lot of digestive issues. There are allergies. These are fairly common. And so these are things that we could address through therapeutic yoga. And in doing so, people feel empowered. So that's one aspect of what we found. The other piece that came up after we left, which was that the Palestinians are new to yoga. They're very interested. We found everywhere we went, there was great enthusiasm and desire to experience yoga, in particular the breathing, because they could feel right away that when they would do longer, deep breathing, that they would relax, that they became clearer mentally. And so with that interest, we were looking at how we could support them going further with yoga in Palestine. And right now, they're dependent upon internationals coming in from outside in order to teach Palestinians. One of our great challenges in refugee camps was that we had translators. And in fact, in working with a psychosocial counselor, we had translators. And the challenge of that is that it goes slowly with translators. There may be also misunderstanding with that. And so it became clear to me that it would be ideal for them to have Arabic-speaking yoga teachers. And to that end, I made a proposal that I have a yoga studio here in Sedona, and my primary mission here is to teach yoga teachers. And so I offered to train yoga teachers, Palestinian yoga teachers, here at my school and have them then go back and be able to start training other teachers in Arabic. So that was what became the new project this time. And this time with Mir and I going, we started to do some more advanced workshops. We started to look at how we could mentor the students. Up till right now, I've had 3 Palestinians that have come to the U.S. and have gone through teacher training programs. So we were able to have them there, and we are able to mentor and work with them in the context of teaching. And also, we were able to introduce Ayurveda this time, as well as some of the yogic philosophy through a conflict resolution workshop called Inner Harmony.
Well, that's impressive. Well, I want to underscore something you said, which may actually surprise some of our listeners, because yoga has become very popular in the United States in recent years, but a lot of people think about yoga as a way to stretch and exercise, get your energy going, a way to relax. But you're saying that yoga is actually can be medicinal, a way of healing. If you have a chronic disease or chronic stress, that yoga can actually help address and maybe eliminate that problem. Is that right?
That's true, and it takes more advanced training to work with the therapeutic aspect, because there's medicine involved in the sense that you have to understand conditions. And so we have a yoga therapy program which uses Ayurvedic principles as a way of understanding imbalances, and then we apply yogic practices to address those imbalances. And so, yes, this is actually a really practical and useful thing that yoga can help, particularly in these situations where we have people that don't or may not have access to traditional, you know, care. And there are ways in which simple things that people can do where they can start to address things through food. For example, the Ayurveda that we teach uses nutrition and food as one of the ways in which we can address imbalances and chronic conditions. And that's something that is generally available to everybody, since everybody eats and everybody cooks. And so that's one of the reasons why it's become an important part of what it is that we do therapeutically.
And I just want to introduce Ayurveda a little for those who may not be familiar. Ayurveda is a medicine system from India and it's considered to be a sister science with yoga. So where yoga is, you know, very healing on many levels, physically, mentally, Ayurveda works more with the food, more with the herbs and the lifestyle to achieve the same type of healing. It's considered a holistic medicine. So it's looking at the whole person, not just physical disease or condition, but how to treat individuals to make a holistic difference in their life on mind, body, spirit levels.
Right. And Mira, you're trained in the Ayurvedic medicine, and also you wrote, you helped your mother write her book, Rama Vernon, who Ruth mentioned earlier, a fantastic book on yoga. And speaking from your personal experience, have you seen yoga actually help people in a therapeutic way, like to heal a problem, a medical condition?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, time and time again. I was the Ayurvedic chef at Seven Centers, where Ruth Hartung is the director of the school. And we saw many, many people, yoga students, come through the training. And we teach them, well, the first class they have is an Ayurveda class, so that they are living the Ayurvedic lifestyle, and I cook the Ayurvedic food. So they have a full experience of both yoga and Ayurveda for 30 days. They're fully immersed in this. And in some ways, it's kind of like a laboratory, because we get to see people go through this amazing transformation of their life. You know, a lot of people consider Seven Centers to be a school of life. And the therapeutic benefits that, you know, maybe they didn't even go in expecting or for that purpose, but the therapeutic benefit has been amazing to see time and time again with the students.
Fantastic. So now you're taking this wisdom and experience and training that you both have and bringing it to a refugee camp in the Mideast. So tell us, you know, exactly where did you go there?
We went to two camps. One camp was outside of Nablus, which is the largest city in the West Bank, called Balata Refugee Camp. And Balata has about 27,000 people in it. And there we taught a yoga class. And our yoga classes are very, you have to start at the very basics, because these people are new to yoga, and they are also have a different culture. So, for example, the women would initially come in with full dress of hijab and their abaya, and then they would take those off and strip down to their sort of sweatpants and tops, and then we would start working with them. One of the things in this culture is that the men and the women cannot intermingle in a yoga class. So each time we teach, we can teach women only. And so one of the things we're looking for, too, is having men work with us so that they can work with the men. Mm-hmm. This is one of our little challenges. So we taught women there. And we just did a little bit of an introduction class to them. What we're doing in the refugee camps is seeing what the level of interest is. And then we also use it as an opportunity for one of the teacher trainers that is Palestinian to also be able to mentor them in the refugee camp. So we can do some of the yoga, and then we can have them direct as well. And they can start to get used to what that would look like, what a class in the refugee camp would look like. We actually have one student who went through the yoga therapy program last year who left Seven Centers. Her name is Shadan. She organized for us this last trip. And what she was paid for to do was to do a diabetes prevention program in a refugee camp that's near Ramallah, and so there she worked with a nutritionist, and they went in and they did a class a week where it was 1 hour of yoga, 1 hour of nutrition, and they did that for 12 weeks. So that program came directly out of her training and is where she's starting to get comfortable with teaching people that have different conditions and that also are not used to this type of exercise or this type of movement or breathing. All of this is relatively new for the people in the refugee camps, yet they respond beautifully and enthusiastically and have many profound testimonials to say about how it makes them feel when they do a class. And we did one class then. Our second class was in the Ida camp, which was in Bethlehem. And after we finished that class, they asked if we could come back that day. They wanted another yoga class. They had such a good time, and they loved the breathing, and they loved how they felt. Mm-hmm. And so our work is, ideally, it would be best if we had our Palestinian teacher trainers do the work in the camps and start to find people that would be interested in becoming teachers so that we could then establish regular daily classes in the refugee camps. Because right now we're just coming in here and there, and there's mm-hmm. not continuity. So all of this is most effective when you've got a program where you can see the results because they've done it for a series or a series of classes or for a period of time. So that's what we're heading towards.
Right. Well, that's the whole adage, it's better to teach people how to fish so they can eat for a lifetime.
Yeah.
So that's fabulous you're doing it. And this is a return trip. You've had now two visits over there. You've got people that you've brought from there to your center in Sedona, Arizona, three of them for training. How many people do you have now who are able to be teacher trainers, people who themselves locally can now become teachers of yoga there?
In the yoga community, we have two levels of training. The basic yoga training is a 200-hour level. And then when you add a 300, which is an advanced yoga training, you come up with a 500-hour level. So right now I have one student that's at a 500-hour level, and I have another one after this next month of training will also be that. So we'll have two, and we really need five. So the next piece will be to work with those that have done the training and start creating curriculum and having them teach parts of the curriculum in settings, with the idea that our goal, and it's a little ambitious, I have to say, but our goal is at some point next year that they will start what's called a 200-hour level yoga teacher training in Palestine that's in Arabic. And so getting people to that level is not easy because, these things take time and experience to do. So I'm having to work a little bit differently for those who haven't had as much education, giving them classes that are set classes they can learn how to teach and then get experience teaching those set classes is one way to work when you don't have the full education. One of our challenges that we've had in January was that two of our teachers that were supposed to come were denied visas. And so this is something that we'll have to continue working around, and it appears to be something that is newer with regards to some of the politics that are going on in our country right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep looking for people that are able to not only that are qualified and have the commitment to want to see this through, but also who are able to get a visa to come to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just mention, too, that all of these that are coming as scholarship candidates. So the nonprofit is receiving donations from people, and that money is going for them to be able to become yoga teacher trainers.
Well, that would seem to be a great contribution to people who are really suffering a lot over there, and this must be like a real joy and literal, you know, breath of relief over there. I've never been to a refugee camp. You know, what is it like? What are the conditions there when you showed up at these two camps? How are people living?
Well, the refugee camps, there's history to the refugee camps. Both of the Balata and Ida camp were established in 1948. And so that's when there was the first push of Palestinians out of their homes into these camps as a result of the war that happened in 1948 with Israel establishing, a homeland. And so they actually look like they're integrated into the city. They don't have businesses. They're all residential. They are housing that's been put together, and usually there's a gate that is a way of entering in. And they're overcrowded.
Mm-hmm.
So, but each refugee camp usually has some type of a clinic that's associated with it, and each one has some type of a what they call an intercultural center, and it's where they will do programs that are like what we're doing, or arts programs, or where people can gather and have classes. We were in our first camp at Balata, we were actually in a space that had a stage, and they had exercise mats that had been supplied for them. I will say that, you know, the Palestinians have been refugees for a long time, beginning in 1948. So right now, my understanding is the number is around 5 million. And there are somewhere in 50-plus refugee camps that are holding Palestinian refugees from the various conflicts that have happened, the primary ones being 48 and 67. And most of them are in, there are a lot of them in the West Bank, but then you also have refugee camps in Jordan. I believe there are a few in Syria and Lebanon. So these are well-established refugee camps that are overcrowded, where people feel it's a temporary housing situation, although now we have generational refugees. Now you have people that have, their grandparents came in, and then their parents were born in the refugee camps, and now the children are. So you've got three generations in some of these camps.
Wow. Those sound like tough conditions to be trying to teach yoga in. There must be a huge amount of kind of chronic stress, health problems, I don't know, maybe malnutrition. You know, what were the conditions that you found by the people who showed up for the yoga class?
Well, it was interesting because we started with our class plan, and of course that had to be quickly adapted because it was very clear there was, there was a disconnect from the body and the breath. So the way that we work with the yoga for the stress, we are having them breathe very deep into the belly, and this reduces stress in the nervous system. But when people are in chronic stress, there's a tension that happens in the diaphragm, and it makes it very difficult for them to breathe deeply. So instantly, that was a challenge, was to have them breathing deeply, and we make physical adjustments to help open their breath. And even in the physical adjustments, we found that they were, tensing their bodies. So we had to really kind of step back with the yoga and make it very, very, very simple. Sometimes even just inhaling the arms up and exhaling down in some cases was as much as we could do. So, and every group is a little different, but that, as you know, in addition to the fact that, you know, doors are opening and slamming and children are coming in and out and cell mm-hmm. phones are going off. And mm-hmm. so, you know, all of these circumstances definitely made it a challenge to teach in that setting.
Yeah, challenging circumstances. What would you say was your greatest challenge in teaching the yoga at the two camps?
I would say that it was... you know, adapt, just as I said, adapting on the spot to make it simple so that it wasn't causing more tension for them to try to follow our instruction, and the translation.
Right.
You know, as we go around and we guide people, we learned a few words like inhale, exhale. and mm-hmm. actually our plan for going back is to come back with more Arabic. So we have a little bit more to work with language. But it was challenging because, we tried to guide through touch. But sometimes that wasn't between the translation and guidance. It wasn't always translating. But even, you know, despite the challenge, it was amazing to see how something very simple and very, it really made a big impact. There, even in the first class we taught, we did a share afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And the attention on bringing their attention into their body and trying to shift the breath to be a deeper breath, that alone was very powerful for them. They really felt a lot opening up in their physical body and felt much calmer. And in both classes, this was the case. So it was inspiring to see that even something so simple, you know, as breathing and circling their wrists and elbows and shoulders and head, you know, just simple movements could still make a big difference for them.
Absolutely. I have a good friend who's a Cherokee medicine man, and he once said to me that if you really understood breath and knew how to work with it, that he believed you could heal any condition of disease with the body through the deep breath and through breathing practices. So it may sound pretty simple, but that's really a profound gift that you brought to the students there.
I would say, too, that with regards to the breath, these are, because they have a unique circumstance where they are in, some of them are in chronic pain, there is this relentless situation externally in their political realm that mm-hmm. just is ongoing. So they actually will take our cues, and they took our breathing, and they hold on to it, and they will do it in a way that a person does that's thirsty for water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have found over these both of these trips that these people have a greater need, and therefore they're willing to take anything that will give them some relief. And we had some, you know, interesting circumstances in the prior trip where teaching the yoga, teaching the breath, teaching a very simple standing pose that we call mountain pose, which is basically a grounding, balancing pose, which strengthens the spine. And we found that the students would, the next day, while they're waiting in line at a checkpoint, they're practicing their yoga, and they're practicing their breathing, and they're practicing how to strengthen their spine in order to, as a different way of handling the stress of waiting and waiting and waiting and long lines as they're coming to a workshop. So we were really thrilled by how people would take something small and integrate it and use it or teach it to someone that they loved and come back and tell us about it. This is not typical of what we see with people who are not in that situation. It was one of the more rewarding things as a teacher is to see the value that they placed. And they also value just the fact that we care enough to come and recognize what's going on with them. That meant a lot to them. And they were very open to us as a result.
Right. I know what you're talking about. I did a leadership seminar for the women of Afghanistan in Kabul a few years ago, and I showed up 2 years before the leadership seminar began, and the room was absolutely packed already. There were over 70 women showed up, and I have never had a group of people so eager to learn and to connect and to engage. There was a real intensity about their participation, and I think it comes from what you're talking about of, you know, people who are in difficult circumstances. This is not like, some weekend treat. This is like can be a lifeline that you're bringing, and they recognize that. How many people were in your classes?
We had groups of, there's always an issue with timing of things. So, for example, in our first class, we were late by an hour. This is part of public transportation, buses, getting someplace. So we had a class of about 7 women in our Balata camp, and because they had stayed around for us to teach the class, and some had to leave. And then we had another group of in the other refugee camp that was 6. And I will say, though, that this is different than the prior trip where there was kind of a spontaneous movement of teaching in refugee camps. And in those classes, we had 40, 50 people that we were teaching with all ages. And such. One of the things that's so important, and I think anybody that does NGO work in international countries recognizes, is that people are grateful for the attention, but when there's coming in and going out and there's not continuity, then they start to become more jaded to the programs that are going on. So it's very important that they can count on and know that they're going to have somebody there, and it's not going to just be somebody showing up to do a yoga class. And there have been quite a few people who've been good about coming and offering things, but that was one of the decisions I made about getting teacher trainers, was I could see that this was an issue of not having continuity of practice or of training, and therefore you're not going to go very far. They'll feel good for a day, and then they won't see you for a year. So that's one of the reasons why I felt that we had to work with Palestinian teachers who would be able to set up regular classes and have people show up to them as a part of their week.
Well, I think that's great. I'm very impressed that you had a trip before, and then you brought some of the people to your center in Sedona, and now you're coming back again. So there is a continuity there that helps to build trust and acceptability, and the fact that you're training local people to do it so they can do it independently. That, to me, is the ideal scenario for doing any kind of work overseas. So hats off to you for doing that.
Relationship building is really important, and that can take time where people trust. And we certainly did a lot of relationship building. So we were also, we did the refugee camps, but we were also working with, at Farasha's, doing regular yoga workshops. So there was an evening introducing Ayurveda for 2 hours, and then there was a follow-up on kitchen medicine that we had. And these were people that were Palestinians. There were a few that were Americans married to Palestinians. There were a few expats that were part of those workshops. And then we also did an evening on back breathing, and then we had a two-day on workshop on chronic stress. And this is also another thing is people have to, they have to arrange to get out of work in order to do these workshops. So that's something that always requires planning, and some people were not able to do this, or they weren't able to do it for full days. And then we also had this three-day conflict resolution workshop that was called Inner Harmony. So we were busy during the whole week doing workshops at the studio. And in the previous trip, we had brought in all of these psychosocial counselors to Farasha as the meeting place to do the workshops. And that meant we had people from all over the West Bank that were coming in on various buses or, you know, taxis or whatever to get in for the workshops. So we were able to do different curriculum, more curriculum this time, some more advanced curriculum than we were able to do in the previous trip, which we were really happy about. And also we had our teacher trainers in all those classes. So we were able to, again, then use them and have them mentor and have them helping us so that we weren't just the only teachers, that we were able to have them teach as well.
Very good. And you mentioned about the yoga and the deep breathing, which is so vital. And you're also skilled in Ayurveda medicine and the food. So what role did the Ayurveda medicine and food play in this trip?
Well, the Palestinians were very excited about the Ayurveda. And Ayurveda is actually, it translates to the science of life. And as people start learning about it, it actually turns out to be very intuitive. And so there was a good response from people to help them to understand themselves, their family, their community. And in terms of the food, that was an interesting piece. I went in feeling very sensitive to coming in as an outsider into a culture which is under persecution as a culture. And whenever in any culture, food is such a vital piece to the culture. So I felt like I had to be very sensitive culturally to, you know, coming in and condemning the way they eat or saying this is how one should eat and these are the healthy foods. And so I felt that it was, you know, important that they understand the qualities of food, but I felt that I needed to tread carefully around that. So also, you know, Shraddha and I, as we were traveling on our way in, we really responded well to the food. The food they have is actually naturally, it's very healthy, and it's very fresh, and they cook at home. And many women are, you know, it's still mainstream to have home-cooked meals, and they put a lot of time and attention and love into their cooking. So, you know, and they also are very well-versed at understanding their folk medicine, understanding what herbs and spices do for the body. And, you know, so I want to honor the knowledge that exists. And so it was a learning for me as well to learn, you know, what are their foods and what are the places of common imbalance, because people still have, they still have health, you know, there are therapeutic needs. There are health challenges that they're facing, largely due to stress, but how we could support on all levels, you know, I still wanted to offer that. So, So, you know, I think the Ayurveda was a really important addition for them to kind of just have another lens at which to look at their environment, their food, and their thoughts and their emotions. And in Ayurvedic medicine, everything really comes back to digestion and our ability to not only digest food, but also the events in our life. And when we are properly digesting food and emotions, then we're coming back to a place of wisdom and health. So I think that piece was very valuable in just helping them to kind of just use that as a framework in which to look at things. What we found too, and this is just something that is kind of funny, but there's such a, you know, every culture has in their cultural diet things in their food that really affect their personality and their behavior. And so, you know, for instance, I always look to Italians, right? They have lots, or Mexicans, there's lots of spices and kind of spicy things in the food, and they're very passionate people. And they could sort of self-reflect instantly when I started talking about the fire element. You know, they really were like, oh yeah, that's us. We have the fire element. And one thing that they absolutely love in their food and cooking is lemon. They take lemons off the trees and eat them like they just love. So just by teaching some of these principles of Ayurveda, they could see how things like that, the amount of lemon in their food, the amount of sour, was contributing to this amount of fire element. So by just presenting these concepts, they were able to already take that and see themselves in that framework.
Good. And Ruth, you mentioned earlier about people, some of them showing up late for the training and kind of dealing with that as an issue. And we know the buses are not always reliable and all of that. But there's also maybe a cultural context here that you know, shapes how people think about time. And when you came back from your trip here 2 days ago, you mentioned the different characteristics of a context culture and a content culture. Can you explain what you mean by that?
This is a core part of a teaching in conflict resolution that I teach based upon what Mira's mother, Rama, had discovered in her work that she did with the Soviet Union in the 80s and the 90s. And when you look at the basis of conflict or the root of conflict using yogic principles, you see this duality of life. And in yoga, they call it Shiva and Shakti, which represent the masculine and the feminine principle. And then there is that becomes also a metaphor for the way our brain works. So we have also a masculine brain and a feminine brain. So that flavors the use of one side of us over another, one nervous system over another, will create tendencies in a personality towards a certain value system or a certain way of looking at things. And this is actually has its basis in social anthropology, where a researcher was observing that you had tribal cultures and they had certain value system, and then you had other cultures that are what he called content, that really used structure, order, balance and harmony within order, controlling, directness, as are all important values in a content culture. So this is one of the teachings, is having people start to look at, and you actually can see when you do yoga that you're more open on one side or the other, and this relates to the right or the left brain and which brain you use more, and that oftentimes that will also tell you what your tendency is. And so when you map that onto a culture, you have cultures that are contextual, and contextual cultures are tribal. They value relationship. So who you are is more important than what you do. And therefore, then, the focus of working with people is who are they? And you use conversation, you use food, you use the weather in order to get to know people. And also, ambiance or space is important to a contextual culture. They also are inclined towards going with the flow. So whatever, they love the detours of life because that's interesting, and they're more relaxed as a result of that. And they tend to enjoy things that are right in front of them, that are more of the sensual nature, that are more of, you know, like smelling the roses along the way or mm-hmm. picking up something that you want to eat. They'll pay more attention to that. A content culture is very goal-oriented. So once they set their goal, they don't stop or they don't generally detour. They fixate upon what it is they're trying to accomplish. And in the content culture, what you do is more important than who you are. So with regards to time, the United States is very much of a content culture. And so we orient time to, you know, we have the phrase time is money. We look at time as being very valuable. We use and fill our time with a lot of things that often don't give us time for just relaxing or eating or things like this because we're on a schedule. There's a structure to our days. So when you start to look at cultures this way, you start to see the problem with communication between cultures. And so, for example, coming from this culture, I expected that people would be on time at 9 o'clock when the workshop started, and I found quickly that that wasn't going to be the case. It never was the case, ever. And it was everything from the buses being late to they stopped to get a coffee to they have kids and, you know, they had to take care of something there or... And it's some of it's environmental, but some of it is just they have a different orientation to it. And so if you take it personally, and it's quite common for a content person or a content culture to take it as being disrespectful, but it's actually not intended that way. It has to do with life, living life in this way, and you don't just rush to get to a point. And they were okay that they might come late or it might have already started, and these were not concerns for them. And so, you know, they are very much relationship-oriented. Everything is works around the family. And whereas in the United States, for example, people are more inclined to ask, what do you do for a living first, rather than to ask about, do you have children? Or, you know, and so we tend to be more accomplishment-oriented. And so this is something that we discussed when it came to the conflict resolution workshop, which we ended up being called Inner Harmony. And we focused a little bit upon that. We talked about that idea of a person who is content versus a person who is a contextual tendency. And what's important in the yoga is that we're both, but we have a tendency towards one. And in the practice of yoga, we're looking to find the common ground, find the bridge between the two. That's actually the focus of the yoga, the integration of those two, representing the integration of the right and left brain, and building bridges between those parts. So we looked at this first individually, and people recognized, they'd say, oh, my father is very content. This is, you know, he gets angry easily if things are, he can't control what's going on, and, you know, so, and then they'd look at it, typically the feminine, but it can be switched in the family. The mother could be more content and the father could be more context. But they recognize these principles first within their families and their relationships. Then we pulled it out and looked at it in terms of cultures. And they recognized right away that the Palestinian culture, like Arab cultures, other Arab cultures, like many Middle East and Asian cultures, are very contextual, and that then we started looking at other countries, you know, European countries, Northern European countries, and everybody could see that Germany was clearly content, or Britain is very content, but Italy is context, and Spain is context. And that allowed us to make the ways of looking at things, the value system, less personal and more a part of the environment that people grow up in. And it lightened everything. And so we were able to look at that in terms of Israel and Palestine. And one of the great, you know, the conflicts between the two of them is that they're completely different cultures. They have a different way of looking at things. They have a different value system. They have a different way of communicating. And that we were able to discuss that separately from everything else and why there would be communication problems between them.
Well, I think that's a really fresh perspective on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, obviously, there's lots of different factors playing in there, but I think you're pointing to some aspect of the miscommunication that goes on is this content culture, which is more ordered and structured, and the context culture, maybe a little more relaxed, emotional, relationship-oriented. I've actually felt that myself, you know, within the past week. I was working with a woman from Hawaii, and I'm definitely more East Coast-oriented, kind of the content, structure, form person, and she's more of the context of, well, you know, go with the flow and show up late and not really be prepared. And, you know, it's the, when I'm looking at it, I see, oh, that's, I bring in the judgments and concerns because that can be rude and unprofessional. And she's looking at me going, boy, you're really, you know, a tight East Coaster here.
It's
like, relax and go with the flow. So I understand what you say. I bet a lot of our listeners experience it in their own families and their own work situations. So thank you for that insight. I think that's a really fresh perspective. We just have a couple more minutes to go, and I want to give you a chance to say for our listeners who want to learn more about your work or support your work. You talked about this trip was funded through your nonprofit at your center. If people want to contribute or if they want to connect with you because they're very interested in what you're doing, how do people connect with you?
So it's easy to get to our website, and which is www.sevencenters.com. And what I'll be doing is posting a little bit of a travelogue about this most recent trip on that. And I have a page that is dedicated to our outreach programs. And the idea of our outreach programs is just taking yoga to places where it normally might not be, where it could be valuable in a social and community context. And so this happens to be the program that we're working on right now, and it'll probably have at least 2 to 3 more years to reach the point of completing the goals that we are set so far. And so if anybody feels inclined and wants to be a part of that or contribute or learn more about what it is that we're doing, then they could contact us through the website or call us. Our phone number is 928-203-4400. And we hope to be able to include more people. Maybe there will be a possibility in the future of taking some people with us when we go on some of our future trips. Right now, it's just we're at the beginning stages, so we feel like it's challenging just even for two of us to go and, you know, kind of lay the sort of foundations for what it is. But we could see that in the future there may be opportunities for people to be able to experience the Palestinians. We felt so at home there. We felt so welcomed and taken care of while we were there. And it's in this, in the intention of the politics that's going on, it's, we feel it's so important to remember the human beings that are involved in these conflicts, and it can get lost in the agendas of government and such. And so that's one of the reasons for us being there is to...
That's great, and that's the website. It's 7 centers. It's the number 7centers.com. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great. And Mira, do you have a website for your work on the healing with Ayurveda?
I do. My website is www.miramurphymedicine.com.
miramurphymedicine.com. Fantastic.
Yes.
Well, that's all the time we have. Ruth Hartung and Mira Murphy, thank you so very much for being with us today and for your important work.
Thank you,
Eleanor. Thank you so much, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.